We're going to be in Amos chapter 7, if you want to turn to that. It's also the text that we're going to use today. The main text is in your bulletin. There's this ongoing story, and if you've been in church for some time, you know this. The story of the children of Israel, God's chosen nation. From the time he called them, from the time he called Abraham, and this nation began to grow, they had this history where they would follow God for a while and then drift away. And then there would be some discipline, some punishment in order to bring them back. That's always what God's punishment was for. Not because he's a monster, but he wanted to bring his children back. Just like we discipline our children, to bring them back and keep them close and safe. There's this on and on. They would come back. They would be with him for a while, and then they would slowly drift away. For us, looking back, it seems like they would just quickly go away. But we're reading thousands of years in little bits and pieces. I think they slowly drifted away. There was this history of them. They had good kings that would come into power for a while, and they would be, you know, and going through Chronicles, 1st and 2nd, going through Kings, 1st and 2nd, you read about these different kings, and Wayne did a series on that a while back, on the good kings and bad kings, and it usually starts out, it'll tell you, this was a good king in God's eyes, or this king did evil in God's eyes, and some of them start out okay and went bad, some of them started bad and went okay, but there's this ongoing cycle where they're faithful for a time, and then they turn away. They get punished and they come back. And we read their history and we just shake our heads and say, those people, poor, dumb people. But we're just like them. Today our text is from Amos. And at this time, just a little bit of background before we pick up in Amos chapter 7. The 12 tribes of Israel are split. They're divided. There's a northern kingdom of Israel. There's the southern kingdom of Judah. Israel to the north is ruled by Uzziah. Uzziah starts out as a good king and slowly fades away. Judah in the south was ruled by Jeroboam II. We don't know a lot about Jeroboam. He was in power for over 40 years, but all really it says about him, other than expanding the territory, is that he did evil in God's eyes. It's about all we know about him. It's enough. Uzziah began as a good king, but in 2 Chronicles chapter 26, it tells us that his success and his pride led to his downfall. Jeroboam II just never was a good king, did evil in the eyes of the Lord from 2 Kings chapter 14. But both kingdoms, north and south, even though they're split, they're kind of cooperating and they're allied a little bit. Both kingdoms are prospering in spite of themselves. They are economically strong. They have military armies that are powerful. They are politically stable, and writers that I've read about describe them as being, while they're politically stable, spiritually smug. That's a bad description to have. To be politically stable, but politically smug. Elisha had predicted their prosperity in a prophecy about 40 years earlier. He prayed and said that, you know, you're going to prosper. Things are going to be good. And so the people mistook their prosperity for maybe they're okay. God's showing favor on us. We must be doing something right. But it wasn't the case. If you read the first few chapters of Amos, you'll see that the upper class enjoyed extravagant lifestyles and indulgences on themselves. But they were getting that by oppressing and selling the poor. It said in earlier places that they would sell the righteous for sandals. They were living immorally and the courts were corrupt. They controlled the courts and got the will of what they wanted. The two nations were prospering in spite of themselves and their immoral and ungodly culture. And Amos is sent by God to tell them that a judgment is coming. So we're going to start reading in Amos chapter 7, verse 1. The sovereign Lord showed me a vision. I saw him preparing to send a vast swarm of locusts over the land. This was after the king's share had been harvested from the fields and as the main crop was coming up. So the people had, when they put their crops in, the king got first shot. He got his harvest first, and then the people would harvest theirs and they could tithe to the temple from that as well. This harvest that was coming, the king would get his, and then the locusts would strip the people of everything that they would get. In my vision, verse 2, I saw the locust ate every green plant in sight. And I said, O sovereign Lord, please forgive us or we will not survive, for Israel is so small. And so the Lord relented from his plan and he said, I will not do it. The second vision was a vision of fire. Verse 4, then the sovereign Lord showed me another vision. I saw him preparing to punish the people with a great fire. The fire had burned up the depths of the sea and was devouring the entire land. And then I said, O sovereign Lord, please stop or we will not survive, for Israel is so small. This was a fire like Sodom and Gomorrah would have seen. And we talked about that as we were studying the life of Abraham. That area wasn't just kind of scorched on the surface. It was scorched to where the topsoil is gone. This is talking about burning up the Red Sea, burning up the Sea of Galilee. This is a consuming fire. But in verse 6, then the Lord said he relented from this plan. I will not do that either, said the sovereign Lord. The third vision is the one we want to focus on, a vision of a plumb line. In verse 7, then he showed me another vision. I saw the Lord standing beside a wall that had been built using a plumb line. He was using a plumb line to see if it was still straight. And the Lord said to me, Amos, what do you see? And I answered, a plumb line. And the Lord replied, I will test my people with this plumb line. I will no longer ignore all their sins. The pagan shrines of your ancestors will be ruined, and the temples of Israel will be destroyed. I will bring the dynasty of the king Jeroboam to a sudden end. Notice Amos does not protest this vision. Verse 10, then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent a message to Jeroboam, king of Israel. Amos is hatching a plot against you right here on your very doorstep. What he is saying is intolerable. He is saying Jeroboam will soon be killed and the people of Israel will be sent away into exile. Then Amaziah sent orders to Amos, get out of here, you prophet. Go on back to the land of Judah and earn your living by prophesying there. Don't bother us with your prophecies here in Bethel. This is the king's sanctuary and the national place of worship. It wasn't God's temple. It wasn't God's sanctuary. It was the king's, according to Amaziah. But Amos replied, I'm not a professional prophet. I was never trained to be one. I'm just a shepherd, and I also take care of sycamore fig trees. But the Lord called me away from my flock and told me, go and prophesy to my people in Israel. Now then, listen to this message from the Lord. You say don't prophesy against Israel. Stop preaching against my people. But this is what the Lord says. Your wife will become a prostitute in this city. Your sons and daughters will be killed. Your land will be divided up. And you yourself will die in a foreign land. And the people of Israel will certainly become captives in exile, far from their homeland. Tough words. Nobody ever wants to draw the prophet card. It's tough to bring that kind of judgment, announce that kind of a judgment onto a powerful king and his appointed priest. But God has watched his people move away from him yet again. And in just this short reading, you can see that the priest Amaziah is protecting this evil king Jeroboam. He doesn't want to hear the prophecy from God. He says, go home and prophesy in your own place. Make your living there, as if Amos is doing this for money. Amaziah calls the place of worship the king's sanctuary and the temple of the kingdom, showing how they felt about that. So Amos gets these visions. The first one, the swarm of locusts going to wipe out the crops. Amos says, Lord, please don't do that. The second vision, the fire that was going to wipe everything out like it did Sodom and Gomorrah. And again, Amos says, please don't do that, Lord. And God relents on both occasions. But then he shows Amos the third vision, the vision of the plumb line. Now, a plumb line is an interesting tool. Jackie, I looked for the one that you gave me years ago when I did this with the children's moment. I can't find it. It's in a box somewhere at home. But a plumb line is such a simple tool. And we've got a bunch of tools at our house. And as we're building a house, we use a lot of those. We have levels. Now, think about a level. You can use a level and they get beat up and thrown around. And Rick, you're a carpenter. You know about this. That level can get out of kilter. If that bubble gets, you know, if that thing gets beat up a little bit, that level is off, it's useless. But a plumb line is so simple. A plumb line is just a string with a weight on the end of it, and it works by the gravity of the earth. You can just tell, you let that line go down, and the plumb line will tell you this is completely straight up and down vertical. So you can make your own little plumb line. If you break your tape measure, break your level, you got to go buy another one. But a plumb line, you can just make your own. It relies on the unchanging principle of gravity. God is talking about and showing Amos that I am going to go back to the unchanging principles that I have established, and that's how I'm going to judge people. They've fallen away from the standard. They've gotten away, and they've slipped away from the standard, and they're no longer upright. The builder who erected the wall used the right standard at first, but now the wall has shifted, and it's no longer standing correctly. This deviated wall leaning over now represents God's people, of course. And Amos doesn't argue. Can you argue with that for a reckoning to come? God makes it clear that he's going to discipline them to bring them back. But how did they get there? How did they get to where that wall was leaning? How does any society drift away? Well, as I said earlier, it's usually not one of those rapid things. It's usually a gradual thing. The kings that you read about through most of the Old Testament didn't just wake up one day and say, I think we're going to erect some Asherah poles today and we're going to start worshiping pagan gods. They intermarried with other cultures, and that culture slowly bled into theirs, and they drifted away. And again, we read about these stories of the nation of Israel and their continuous cycles of drifting away from God, and we shake our heads and we wag our fingers, but really we are just like them. The drift away from God is an insidious thing. Insidious is a word that every time I hear that word, it's not a word we use a lot, but when I hear it, it takes me back to a time in my military training where I heard that word repeatedly over a 2-day training course. I went to Tacoma, Washington. It was Fairchild Air Force Base in Washington, and I'm lost on the city now. But I had to go there to go through the altitude chamber. The altitude chamber, and you've seen this if you watched An Officer and a Gentleman from a long time ago. They put a bunch of you in this box, and they begin to suck all the air out of it to simulate what it's like to go up to altitude while you're still here on the ground. So as they're sucking all the air, which has oxygen in it, out of this thing, you begin to get the feeling and the effects of hypoxia, the lack of oxygen. And they told us over and over, the loss of oxygen is an insidious thing. You don't feel it coming on until it's too late. And so we would have our masks on, and we're watching everything and the indicators. We can see the altitude that we're simulated at. And then they would have us to do something. They were like, half of you, not everybody, but half of you, and you number off, take your mask off. And they would have those of us without our mask on start to do a simple task, like arrange cards 1 through 5. And you couldn't do it. Your brain's not getting the oxygen that it needs. And finally they would say, okay, somebody else reach over and put their mask on. Well, first they would say, Lieutenant Jones, put your mask back on. And I'm just sitting here looking at cards. And I'm going to die. And it's happened. People have flown perfectly good airplanes until they ran out of fuel because their oxygen quit, and nobody realized it until it was too late. It is an insidious thing. That's the word they kept using over and over. A cultural shift away from God creeps up on you. It's like an insidious thing, like the frog put in a pot of water. If it's cool water, you put them in there, you start the heat up, they'll stay in there until they boil to death. It just creeps up on them. So how does that work out in a culture? Well, I'm going to give you a modern day example of this cultural drift. And I'm going to talk about some things in history. I'm going to talk a little bit about a political event. I'm going to talk about some entertainment. And I'm going to talk about some church activity. I am not talking politics when I just go back and talk history. And trust me, both sides, both parties are equally guilty about this. So please know that I'm an equal opportunity offender when it comes to this topic. But go back to 1972. If you know, every scandal that we have today, they put the gate ending on it. because it was the Watergate conspiracy. In 1972, a group of men from the White House, from the Nixon administration, broke into the Watergate Hotel to spy on the opposition. And as it would be, these guys were bumbling idiots, and it came to light that the break-in occurred. Nixon denied any knowledge of it. He began to get involved in a cover-up of it. And as things began to trickle out, the truth came out. It was clear that Nixon had lied to the American public, that he did know about what was going on. And he ended up having to resign in shame rather than face impeachment. Fast forward about 16 years, the 1988 presidential campaign. Gary Hart was the front runner for his party. Gary Hart looked like he was probably going to be the next president of the United States. And now today you're like, who's Gary Hart? You know, we have to go back and think about that. But Gary Hart had to drop out of the race when it was revealed that he was having an extramarital affair. Americans were shocked. They were saddened. They wanted a politician with better morals, just like they were shocked by Richard Nixon's behavior. They wanted better from their politicians, and Gary Hart had to drop out of the race. In 1995, fast forward yet again, there was the Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky scandal. The president was held in contempt of court for perjury. He was lied. It was clear that he lied to the American people. He was impeached by the House, but exonerated by the Senate, stayed in office, and got reelected. People just weren't so shocked anymore. We heard phrases on TV from commentators and news anchors like, well, hey, everyone cheats on their spouse. And when it comes to sex, of course everybody lies. You're not going to tell the truth about that stuff. So give the guy a break, right? It wasn't the same. People weren't shocked like they were in 1972 or 1988. And that's just a really short slice of history. How does a society drift like that? From resigning into shame, in shame, to winning re-election and not having any shame whatsoever. Well, let's look back at another slice of the culture. Let's look back at our entertainment. I started going back and I was like, what were the popular shows on TV in the 1970s? In 1970. Oh, this was amazing. Marcus Welby, M.D., The Waltons, Bonanza, Mayberry RFD, Here's Lucy. And remember, Lucy and Ricky were married, but how did they sleep? What were their sleeping arrangements? Twin beds. Because we didn't even want to see a hint of anything inappropriate, even though they were married. We just didn't want to think about that. That's what it was like. Things like Gunsmoke were popular on TV. Ironside and Hee Haw, which we sang the Hee Haw song at our place yesterday. My Three Sons, the Carol Burnett Show. But if you go from 1970 and you start clicking each successive years, you start seeing a little bit of a change come through. New shows started popping up. Mod Squad. Laugh-In. Dick Rowan and Martin, you know, their show started to push the boundaries a little bit. The Flip Wilson Show, The Devil Made Me Do It. Then Maude came on. And now, by today's standards, those shows are just, they're tame. And y'all are going like, what are these shows? What are they talking about? You got to be a certain age to know these shows. But these shows that were beginning to creep in, by today's standards, they were like, they're tame. But they began to show a slow move away from the Mayberry RFD and the Gomer Pyle kind of shows. And soon broadcast TV standards were loosened a little bit, and more was allowed, and more was allowed, and more was allowed. And then cable TV came along, and it wasn't just the three networks anymore, and the door was opened up for more. And then satellite TV came on, and decency regulations didn't apply. And you could stream or you could watch on satellite anything. And I'm telling you, anything you wanted. Today, we can stream 1,000 channels of different things and movies just on demand. And now we're no longer shocked by anything that comes on TV. We've lost our sensitivity to it. Paul talked about this in Ephesians 4 when he was talking about the pagans, which pretty well describes where we are. He says they are darkened in their understanding. They've lost their sensitivity. They've lost their sense of shame. And now they just give themselves completely over and continually lust for more. Well, producers and directors in television started to reach deeper and deeper, trying to find some shock value. The standards have been lowered. The wall is leaning even more. And soon gravity's just going to pull it over and it's just going to collapse completely. One more slice or indicator of our culture. Start looking at church attendance statistics from 1970 moving forward. Any graph you pull up, any way you slice it, it's just like stock market crash. People quit going to church. So while we're getting all of this cultural feed into our living rooms of this junk, we're no longer listening to God. We've tuned him out. And so where are we today? Well, politicians now? Oh my goodness. People who once would never have a chance at even a local public office because of their past public mistakes and choices and immoral actions are now in some of the highest offices in the land. And you may think your candidate is good because they acknowledge God or espouse honorable things. But I can't help but think about what Jesus said when he quoted Isaiah. They honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Too many of our politicians say one thing but do another. The things that shocked the nation 30 to 40 years ago were commonplace. It's ho-hum. And party leaders are more worried about protecting seats in Congress and their thin majority or minority than they are about the integrity of the institution. And the politicians that are elected, they're just elected by the people, and it's just a reflection of our society. The wall is leaning badly. And it may seem normal to us now. That's the problem. We've gotten so far away from that standard. The level is broken. The tape measure has been stretched. And what we think is normal is not. We need to go back and look at the true standard. As Todd said in class this morning, we've got to go back to and look at the will of God. God carried out his judgment on Israel because he had had enough of it. He was sick of it. And the country was destroyed. And the people who survived went into captivity in Babylon for 70 years. I'm afraid we may have something like that coming, but I don't know of a country that's worse than we are. I mean, better than we are. Who do we go to? Who would we be held captive by? But someday God is going to bring out his plumb line and he's going to hold it up to all the nations and he will no longer ignore our sins. He's going to hold his plumb line up against you and he's going to hold it up against me and he's going to see how far we've drifted, how far we are leaning out of upright. God will not wink at our sin and say, oh, they just don't know any better. Acts talks about that. There was a time when he winked at our ignorance and said, ah, they don't know any better. He's past all that now. He demands that we change and that we repent. Our call to worship from Psalm 85 in verse 7 that I pointed out says, Lord, show us your unfailing love and grant us your salvation. He has shown us his love. It's by what he did to bring us back. All through the Old Testament, God disciplined the people to bring them back. For us, to bring us back, he paid the ultimate price. He gave his own son. He showed us his love in the form of Jesus. Jesus came here, lived with us, among us, showed us how to live. He showed us what that standard was. And of course, we see how difficult a standard that is. But he made it easier for us. We know we can't live up to that perfect standard. So he just said, admit it. Admit that you can't live up to that standard. We die to ourselves. We put him on in baptism so that when God looks at us, he doesn't see our sin. He doesn't see what we do wrong. He doesn't see us leaning so far over that we're about to collapse. He looks at Jesus. He looks at us and he sees Jesus. And he sees his righteousness, his standing upright. He knows that Jesus that we put on in baptism makes us upright again. He has given us righteousness to correct what we cannot. And when we have Jesus on in baptism, we stand tall and we stand erect. Not on our own doing, but on his. And we don't have to fear the coming judgment. And it is coming. It's coming. Whether we see it in our lifetime or we see it after our death, the judgment is coming. So let Jesus make you upright again. Don't let the world be your standard. Don't let television say, I am better than that. At least I'm not living like the Kardashians, right? No, that's not the standard. The standard is Jesus. If you haven't been baptized into his name, do that today. And if you want to talk more about that, we're here. I'll visit with you. The shepherds here will visit with you. You can come during the song that we're going to sing, or you can talk to me afterward. But don't delay. It's time. If there's any way we can help you, we invite you to come while we stand and sing. Thank you.